Hello, this is the Fakeologist speaking. You're listening to Master Fake Theater, where I present to you some of my favorite 9/11-centric audios. I selected these audios based on the idea that they will help further your knowledge of the hoax that 9/11 was. While I can't endorse every thought in each audio, I do think they're worth your while. Please visit Fakeologist.com to explore endless hours of 9/11 and media fakery research. Thank you for listening, and on with the Master Fake Broadcast.
Restart my computer repeatedly, and then you got to get Nicecast and Skype in the right order and finally get on. And I guess we are at last there. My special guest today has a background in biology and computer science, and he has been paying a great deal of attention to the skies, especially since 9/11. His name is David Arnold, and the topic we're going to discuss today is chemtrails. David, it's a pleasure to get you on the air at last.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I'm really sorry about that delay. We lost we lost one segment. We got three to go. Tell us a little bit about what you've been noticing about chemtrails. And are you in the Midwestern United States now?
I am. I'm in Missouri.
You're in Missouri, and one wouldn't think that chemtrails would be particularly significant in the Midwest, although, depending what they are, they could be significant anywhere. Go ahead, tell us about what you've been figuring out.
Well, I saw contrails that weren't contrails. They persisted, and I started asking questions and listening to people who were calling them chemtrails. And one thing leads to another when you investigate. There's a wonderful saying that there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation, by Herbert Spencer. So I investigate. It's interesting to me, so I investigate, and some of these claims just seem outrageous at first.
You mean some of the theories about what's really going on with chemtrails?
Oh, well, chemtrails, that they're chemicals in the sky. And the first thing that I had to get past there was somebody pointing out a tea kettle on the stove. It shoots steam out. That's condensation. That's what contrail means, condensation trail. And right by the tea kettle, it's clear, and then it condenses an inch or so away, maybe half an inch, and then it shoots into the room some number of inches and dissipates and disappears. And that's condensation. And it's the same thing we see when the airplanes in our childhood used to fly over, and there'd be that little white tail that would follow the plane across the sky, disappearing as it went. And then somebody pointed out that the reason that my car was filthy after a rainstorm was that the clouds contain dust particles by necessity in order to condense water in the air and keep it floating in clouds until it comes down as rain. So the rain contains dirt because in order to have a persistent cloud, it has to be moisture around particles. So this sort of step-by-step took me to understanding that persistent contrails had to be water vapor with a particle. Did that answer your question?
Well, I'm not sure it does. I mean, are you suggesting that the problems we're having with chemtrails are nothing but contrails? I mean, we got these crisscross patterns. We have lots of studies of what's going on there, and but what it does not look like is dust and water, I'll tell you that. Is that
well, it comes down to what is the dust.
Okay, well, and carry us forward, yeah.
Right, it turns out that we've got an awful lot of aluminum and barium and other interesting things falling on our landscape, and that stuff constitutes the requisite property of a particle for the for the water to collect around. And so if you go to various websites, there's a company called Weather Modification, Inc. I don't really mean to give them a free ad, but I think it's important for people who don't think that we have weather modification available from small turbo dual prop planes to go to their site and see that you can hire these folks and they will spray stuff in your air and they will either give you rain or a clear day. And you can dial it up and they're in that business. So there were just an awful lot of barriers to me to believing that any of this stuff was real. And so each barrier as it falls down then leaves me with a new starting point for the rest of my investigation. So what are the chemtrails? Well, they're particles in the air. And, you know, then the question becomes, is every plane that's leaving a persistent contrail producing the dust, or are they using dust left over from prior flights or rocket shots that have exploded large amounts of dust in our air, and the answer to that is impossible to really tell. There was a fascinating show created, or at least broadcast by BBC from Horizon, called Global Dimming, done, I believe, back in 2004 or 2005, and it was about what happened after 9/11. 9/11, of course, we kept all of our planes on the ground, including military aircraft, which is just a huge question mark, why we grounded our military aircraft. But we grounded all of our airplanes and didn't let anybody fly into our space for 3 days. And it turned out that a number of scientists in different parts of the world noticed that the skies were brighter, the blue was deeper, and the temperature planet-wide went up anywhere from half a degree to a degree and a half, which for them was significant. And so several, possibly more than three, independent folks started looking into why this was. And so sort of the punchline at the end of their show was that if we actually reduced the number of particles from coal-burning plants and automobiles and industry in our atmosphere, we might have climate problems because they had been participating in our climate in a way that was perhaps counterintuitive. And they never made any mention in Global Dimming of chemtrails or weather modification, except by the evidence of those 3 days after 9/11. So 9/11 and Global Dimming connected themselves in my mind, and I started looking for other connections.
Yes, I mean, the BBC, as I have discovered, based upon personal experience, is not a reliable source for trustworthy information, especially about 9/11. I've been involved in two different documentaries they produced, and they substantially misrepresented my views, and in fact, in the second instance, they actually substituted images other than the images I was addressing to make it appear as though I did not know what I was talking about, or as though the evidence contradicted my views, which led me to actually publish a piece about their techniques of disinformation under the heading of the BBC's Instrument of 9/11 Misinformation, which is their Conspiracy Files series. Was the show about dimming in a Conspiracy Files series, do you recall, David?
No, it's not. In fact, I think that the show itself is actually good science. They went to evaporation pan readings that had been running for 100 years and demonstrated that by reducing the cloud cover, more heat would get in that particular scenario. One of the things I find really disturbing about our sources of information is that any particular source may put out the truth, half-truths, or no truth at all, and it's sort of Russian roulette as to what you're getting in any particular time. So I can't discount everything the BBC does, but they're certainly caught red-handed over and over, as are all of the other major and minor outlets of information, putting out stuff that's clearly untrue.
Yes. And in the case of global dimming, what was your conclusion about what they were doing there?
Well, I think they actually had real information correctly analyzed. The concern with weather modification is whether the clouds will keep more heat in or keep solar radiation out under the idea of solar radiation management. And it turns out that clouds do both. If you have a clear night, no cloud cover, it'll be colder because the night sky as a black body receives the radiated heat and the clouds reflect it back onto the earth. If, on the other hand, during the day you have a cloud between the sun and the planet, that cloud may well reflect 5, 10, or 15% of the light back off of the planet. And some people, I think you've had people on before who referenced what in the world are they spraying. The solar energy expert on there indicates that if we do manage solar radiation and reduce the amount of heat that gets to the planet's surface, we'll also have a negative effect on our ability to use solar energy. So all these things have two edges, and I suppose frustratingly enough, just the issue of what does a cloud do? Does it keep heat out or keep heat in? The answer turns out to be, well, it does both.
Well, let me ask David. I take it this BBC show was really intended to demonstrate that global warming is not a bona fide phenomenon, at least not insofar as there's been a human contribution, even though since the Industrial Revolution we've been pumping stunning quantities of pollutants into the atmosphere, and when you consider the massiveness of the automobile exhaust, coal burning, massive fires in the Amazon, all this sort of thing, it's very difficult for me to believe, from the point of view of evolution, that this isn't a relevant factor that is indeed contributing to global warming. I have come down on the side of Al Gore about all of this and his inconvenient truth and so forth. And I take it this BBC production was intended to offset that and that you may be, in fact, inclined to agree with him.
Well, I wish you an opportunity to see this particular show, because I don't think that's what they did, actually. They did focus on particulates and its impact, but they were very much supporting the opinion that the particulates produced by man have had an enormous impact on the climate, and that were we to eliminate all of the particulates rapidly as we actually could, that there would be dire climate change produced just by that, and that we may be in this kind of a Mexican deadly embrace where putting particulates into the air is bad for us and bad for our climate, but taking them out is also bad, and we're stuck between two bad choices.
What do you think they're actually putting out in the atmosphere? You mentioned aluminum and barium, and I've certainly had confirmation of that from other sources. Some have also suggested that there were weird kinds of biological entities involved here that can produce a weird disease called Morgellons. Have you run into any of that research and sought to assess it?
Well, I've seen the Morgellons claims, but I haven't been able to get any citations that really have the kind of authority that I would like. That having been said, of course, the Church Commission reported on the CIA's activities in the mid-1900s. Our own government has actively been testing biological agents on the populations of major cities because our reporting is so much better than foreign nations. And so they just commonly use us as guinea pigs with everything from radioactive fallout to putting plutonium in milk and oatmeal of orphans to see what the impact on a human body would be. These are gruesomely stupid things to do and immoral, and this is our own government. So though I can't identify anything that would cause Morgellons, certainly the assertion that it's going on is not out of character with the kinds of things that our government has been admitting that it does literally for decades.
It is a stunning history and very sordid, unbelievable stuff. Going back to the Tuskegee syphilis experiments and a host of others, and what you're describing.
Well, the Tuskegee. Yeah, the Tuskegee are interesting because even though they're very popularly known, many people believe that it consisted of an experiment where people with syphilis were simply not treated. Few people realize that people who were clean were deliberately infected with syphilis as part of that experiment, and they were denied treatment as well. And I think it's just very interesting how even when the information gets out, we tend not to capture the entire story correctly, and we don't follow the implications. So what does it mean that our government did that? And what does it mean as it applies to us? It's just surprising to me how difficult it is to actually follow a fact with a question.
Well, what's your answer to that question, David?
Well, I'll tell you, I have decided that from my experience with 9/11 and other outrageous claims that I found there was enormous documentation of multiple independent sources. Say, for instance, the assertion that AIDS was created in a laboratory. Well, you can go to Congressional Record, House Resolution 19050, and read in Part 6, page 129, exactly what they were talking about. It was a $5 to $10 million project, take a few years, and they even discuss the moral ramifications, etc. And that's public record, and then you can trace
It's in the public record that Congress financed the development of AIDS in a laboratory and even debated the moral implications. What was supposed to be the rationale for developing this horrendous?
Well, the idea was that they would create a synthetic biological organism to which human immunity through evolution had never been able to occur as a process.
There was no naturally evolved immunity because it hadn't been present in the environment in the past thousands of years. Yes.
Right, because it was an artifact. And so the that was the principle behind it, and the reason for doing it was if we don't do it first, somebody else will do it. Now, this brings up another question of thought for me, and I think your background is in the science of science itself.
Yes, history and philosophy of science, yes.
It seems to me interesting when I'm sitting around with a number of people and they pick out somebody who has been caught in a lie, and then they take some other claim that that person makes, and they give it the authority of truth as if they can tell when somebody else is lying and when they aren't. It just blows my mind. So if they say, oh, well, it's our job to do this because if we don't do it, somebody else will, and then we'll be behind, and we'll have a hard time creating an antidote. One of the issues involved with the creation of biological and chemical weapons is that you want, if possible, to create an antidote for your own people so that what you shoot doesn't literally come back and get you. So there were a number of reasons on that one small page. I have had the experience, though, of being told that somebody's job was to create cover stories for cover stories. You might ask, why do you need a cover story for a cover story? Well, anything that's kept secret is kept secret for the reason that that's more advantageous than letting the information out. But from time to time, it becomes more valuable to leak the secret than to keep it. There are all sorts of reasons for that. When that happens, there's a cover story. You have to make it seem plausible that the information got out so that it's sort of a magic trick. You try to provide a reason that's not the real reason to keep prying eyes off what's really going on. And, of course, the problem is there are a number of people who are not privy to the reason you are releasing secret information who know the secret and who know that the cover story is absolute bunko. So for those people, you have to create another cover story that gives legitimacy to the cover story for those people who would know better otherwise. And, of course, in this information, there's no necessity of stopping with one layer or two layers. You can go to three or four or five, whatever you have the funding to do and you think is important. So Thomas Pynchon, did I say that right?
Yes, yes.
P-Y-N-C-H-O-N?
Yes.
There's one quote from him that just burns holes in my mind. And it goes like this. If they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers.
Yes.
And I find that comes up over and over. So one of the things that I'm looking at, sort of redirect toward your question, is I've become aware of a number of these facts, and from point to point, I research down to primary sources from multiple independent reporters so that there's some triangulation of the information, some legitimacy. And then I'm beginning to take some steps back because knowing things solves nothing. There are other steps. And I started looking at the Genovese murder and the 38 witnesses and all of the mythology about why people didn't do anything to help her when she was being stabbed to death over half an hour. And it turns out that there are about five steps. And these five steps lead to taking appropriate action. And if you don't make it through the five steps, you don't take appropriate action.
David, let's take our first break here and then come back to the five steps. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal with my special guest today, David Arnold, talking about a variety of rhetoric. Ben Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with David Arnold. We were talking, David, about, well, you were talking about cover stories for cover stories, but also now about what it takes, a number of steps that are required for people to actually get involved, even when it's something as blatant as a murder in an alley in New York City, and there are dozens of people witnessing this poor woman being stabbed to death over about 30 minutes' time. Tell us about that case and what you learned from it.
Well, yeah, that's the famous New York City Genovese murder, and it's interesting that it's named for the victim, not the perpetrator, sort of like the Trojan horse. The Trojans were the people who were the victims. It was a Greek horse, at any rate.
But given to the people of Troy, yeah.
Right, yeah, given to the Troyans. So 38 people were identified as having witnessed some part of the murder, and amazingly, a number of the people didn't realize what was going on in any sense. Some thought that it was a lover's quarrel, that was none of their business. A large number of the people actually didn't understand the seriousness of what was going on. Even the people who did understand the seriousness of what was going on, the stunning thing out of that 38, numbers of them were very upset about it. The mythology is that all people are just callous. They did not care. And that's not the case. These people cared a great deal, but they didn't know what to do. Now, from the outside, 2020 hindsight, Monday morning quarterbacking, it seems obvious what you do is you call the police. But for those people in the experience, they knew what was going on. They didn't know what to do. And there are a number of other factors. So a number of studies went by to explore what really happened instead of the mythology, and four steps were initially thought up, and then a fifth step was added. And so the first step is you have to notice that something is happening. And with chemtrails, a lot of people don't notice that anything's happening. So they don't act because they don't get past step one. The second step is you have to interpret the meaning of the event. If it's an emergency, if somebody's been stabbed, if they're having a heart attack, you have to understand they aren't just goofing around or taking a nap or having heartburn. You have to interpret the meaning of the event correctly, or you don't get past step two. For step three, you have to take responsibility for providing help. A number of interesting experiments were created where smoke would come under a door and they'd see how many people reported to the experimenter that smoke was coming under the door when the experiment was clearly supposed to be some other task that was keeping them occupied. And surprising.
You know, as a form of diversion, they have them working on a certain
right.
task, but they're really testing their response to the threat of smoke coming under the door, which also ought to alarm them and lead to some kind of immediate action.
That's right. That's right. And so it seems that there is a very strange impact on having multiple witnesses. If a person was alone in the room, the highest percentage of people reported the action, right, that smoke is coming in. If there were two people in the room, the numbers dropped, and if there were three or more, it became virtually a non-event. People didn't report it. And so they call that the dilution of responsibility. If you see other people seeing the same thing you're seeing, it dilutes the responsibility. And on top of that, in the case of the Genovese murder and in some other cases, there is pluralistic ignorance, a fancy name for assuming that somebody else has done something already, because I can't be the first person to see this, so somebody else saw it already and has done something appropriate. It's a flight of fancy, but it's what happens in bystander situations.
It's a form of excuse, too, isn't it? It excuses you from doing something that you really obviously ought to be doing, and yet you pass it off.
Well, there are social, there are sometimes social factors where people don't want to be the object of ridicule, and it's a little strange how some of those factors play into place, but certainly if you have something like 9/11 or chemtrails and you want to keep it hidden, you want to make fun of people who bring these things up and try to get past step one, notice that something is happening. And so that encourages people at step three not to take responsibility for what's going on because, what can they do anyway? And then step four is know how to help. Now, in the Genovese murder, how to help might be go down and break up the fight, or it might just be call the police.
Just to comment ever so briefly, David, on the point you were just making about ridiculing those who raise issues about 9/11. See,
oh yeah.
In the theory of punishment, there are two forms of punishment that affect the individual. You know, why you punish somebody? One is pure retribution, just as sort of evening the score in some sense of justice. But another is rehabilitation of the individual. The third and fourth, however, have a public dimension. One is setting an example, and the other is removing a threat. Now, you set an example, a negative example, when you ridicule somebody for raising issues about 9/11. And, of course, in a way, if you can rehabilitate them so that they don't continue to do this, you also, in effect, are removing a threat from society, as well as, of course, securing a form of retribution that they even did what they should not have done from the point of view of the perpetrators of these acts. So just reflecting that you're, I think, right on the spot, that the idea of ridiculing those who raise the issues, who even notice, is intended to set a negative example and thereby discourage other members of society from following up.
Well, and it's emotional. And just as a little bit of foreshadowing, I started looking into magic tricks because they rely on deception and prior planning and defects in human thinking and perception. And one of the issues is just after you do your tricky step, you're supposed to make your audience laugh, because in laughter they lose the ability to think backwards and put together pieces of an intellectual puzzle. And one might imagine that being an emotional response, if you could induce fear or terror in people, that emotionality would equally drag it away from, drag their ability away to think.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, continue.
Number four is know how to help. And for the last couple of years, that one's been the one that's been getting my attention a lot, because for a lot of these problems, if you look into Henry Kissinger's famous remark about useless eaters, people who eat and are useless, or even Jacques Cousteau's commentary on the necessity of reducing the planetary population, if you follow this history of the idea of us having too many people on the planet, that being a problem, it's usually held by the elite. And just as a footnote, it hasn't been true yet. You've got to know how to help, and so how do you help against something like a plot to change the weather of the planet, or create crops that only grow in aluminum-infested soil, so they have to be GMO, aluminum-resistant, patented seeds, and then those seeds may also be the corn that Monsanto developed with spermicide to make sure that males who ate that corn would not reproduce. All these things start fitting in together, and the question is, well, okay, what if I do know about all this, and I take responsibility for doing something myself? What do I do? you have to know how to help. And competency is the fourth step. If you can convince people that they are too ignorant or too stupid or inept, they won't try. And, you know, of course, Star Trek, the alien race, if you can call them that, the Borg assert resistance is futile. And, of course, if you accept that, then you fall victim to Sun Tzu's contention that when a military actually has to fight a war, they have not done their first job, which is to win without the fight. So knowing how to help is a Gordian knot in and of itself. And if we understand that our electronic tabulation as well as our electronic voting machines are worse than games of chance, that they are occult opportunities to cheat in secret, then voting for better people may not actually be a real option. And if we understand that mainstream press has been infiltrated by the intelligence, call that the spy community, very effectively over the last 3, 4, 5 decades, then the press isn't really an avenue for influencing change. So the question of knowing how to help is to some extent an unanswered question. And one of the problems with approaching that is just because some elections are severely tampered with doesn't mean that all of them are. And so the tendency for people to be all-or-nothing thinkers, if some elections are tampered with and we can't trust elections, that's true, then we shouldn't participate in them because there's no hope. Well, that's not necessarily true. And so drawing the line instead of just instinctively or reactively going to the opposite, it's a hard thing to fight. So trying to find out step four, what to do next, knowing how to help, that becomes a big issue. And then number five is actually providing the help. And just because you know how to help doesn't mean that you will actually provide the help. There are all sorts of techniques for getting people who've even managed to get to step four and know how to help to not help. Helping has real costs. It might be very dangerous. And people's beliefs might even be manipulated so that they choose inaction over action because they think that it's their moral obligation to let God's plan unfold without their intervention, without realizing that whatever they choose is an intervention. But, you know, cognitive dissonance is a mysterious thing anyway. So these five steps, I think, are really a good thing to look at when we're looking at something like chemtrails, otherwise known as persistent contrails or weather modification or geoengineering, because they are the sieve that reduces the available number of people who can really help. Those that notice something's happening, that interpret the meaning of the event correctly, who take personal responsibility for providing help, who know how to help, and who actually make the choice to do it. So I would really encourage listeners to this to contemplate number four and publicize what we can really do and to make some distinctions, because going from one polar extreme to the other doesn't really work real well. I was in a totally unrelated political environment, and a bunch of people who seemed completely in opposition to my efforts, I went in one day and I asked the administrator for certain records, and he said very nicely to me, "David, I don't have time to get that for you." And I said, "Oh, there has to be a way." And he turned and looked at me and he said, well, you could make a Freedom of Information Act request, which requires a response within 10 days. And I just was floored. Here, one of the people who had just stonewalled my investigation had literally told me how to make them help. And so I like to not make too many assumptions about what's going on and just stay open to opportunities. And I would bet that somebody out there has a bag full of knowing how to help that they should share.
Well, that's very interesting. Let's go through the five steps you talked. One was noticing. The second was interpreting. I think the third was knowing what to do. The fourth was actually doing it.
Third is taking responsibility.
Assuming, accepting that you might have a role here at all. Yeah.
Right, that's three. And four is knowing how to help.
Knowing how to help, and then the fifth is actually doing it.
Right.
Yeah, because if you don't feel that you have the role responsibility, that third step is really quite important because there are a lot of ways it could be cast off, as you were suggesting, from the group phenomenon, for example. I think you're right that when an individual confronts a situation, they act on their interpretation and understanding and go ahead and do it. But the social context makes such a huge difference. It's like the case of belittling and ridiculing those who are trying to get to the heart of the matter about 9/11. And now we have 30,000 drones that are going to be flying over the United States. David, the situation is so bizarre. I cannot believe what has become of this country. It's like we've been turned inside out, literally.
And it's hard to believe for instance, the number of drones. And even if you were off by 20,000 drones, or there were only 1,000 drones, there are people who will find it virtually impossible to comprehend that we've got drones flying over us, and, you know, we really aren't that dangerous.
What does the government really fear from the American people? I mean, this is really quite ridiculous as I see it. I mean,
they sell fear.
They sell fear. They're marketing fear. They're trying to manipulate us based on fear. That was, of course, the primary objective of the fabricated events of 9/11, to instill fear into the American people so that they could more readily manipulate us for political purposes. And they succeeded brilliantly.
Indeed.
So we reverse our entire history of foreign policy by never attacking any nation that hasn't attacked us, and now adopt a new complete inverse of that by now attacking other nations even though they have not attacked us. And we do it again and again and again, and then we use NATO to do it yet again. So we invade... go ahead.
Even that is an interesting factoid because, say, for instance, our invasion of Grenada...
Yeah.
Nobody attacked us.
I know, that was ludicrous. That was a purely political stunt.
In fact, the Bay of Tonkin?
Yes.
The fiction was that somebody had attacked us, but the reality was nobody had attacked us.
Correct.
So the thing that amuses me about things like this, if I can just dwell on this for a second, is that we run around with ideas, and I do it, I mean, I'm constantly struggling to identify these errors in memory that I carry around that have been very carefully placed in my head and everybody else's, because we use memes, we use phrases, we use history that's not real history, like the assertion that we changed a policy. Well, literally we may have changed the written policy, but we didn't change the factual policy. Our factual policy hasn't been like that since before colonial days. We attacked plenty of people for 200 years that hadn't attacked us yet.
Nice.
You know? And so
yeah.
what I what I continue to look for in the things that I hear are...
You're right. The difference between our espoused foreign policy and our actual practice has always been gargantuan.
Well, it really is.
Yeah.
Well, say, for instance, something very strange. If you look at moon video and you see the flag on the moon with the little arm out wiggling, does that mean that the picture was not taken on the moon, or does that mean that it's false that there's no atmosphere on the moon, or does that mean that it was a metallic mylar flag and it was under the influence of electrostatic influences? We don't know what it means. We know what it might not mean. But there's a real tendency in human thought to say, well, if it's not this, it has to be, and pick one thing. Well, that's like the whole conundrum about the set of all things that are not yellow. Well, there's a problem with those two sets. They aren't symmetrical at all. I mean, things that are yellow have to be physical. Things that aren't yellow can be intangibles. So we have, as humans, a number of characteristics about the way we think and what we pass off to ourselves and others as the drawing of inferences and deductive thinking and all of that that really are quite questionable. And so it's really hard, in my experience, to take a look at assertions that people make and not buy them whole. And I think it's very important, one of the assumptions that people who don't want to believe in 9/11, they make is that, well, that's too big a secret, it couldn't be kept.
You mean who don't want to believe the truth about 9/11?
Well, that's always a good guess as well, but you know, they don't think about the H-bomb, the nuclear bomb, the stealth bomber. All these things, lots of things, are kept secrets by tens of thousands of people. Even in the Great World Wars, there was a saying that ran around, loose lips sink ships.
Yeah.
And entire populations kept secrets. Well, so there's just this inconsistency in thinking. And so I have been interested in the fact that the 38 people who witnessed the murder of the poor woman, a large number of them actually didn't witness the murder. That's a mischaracterization. They heard the commotion. They didn't understand it properly. And they didn't pay any more attention to it. And it resulted in a woman dying, but they weren't sitting around a ring, 38 people, watching from 10 feet, somebody get stabbed and murdered over 30 minutes. So, we get told these things about ourselves. Oh, we are these terrible people who sit around and watch a helpless woman getting stabbed to death. And that's not actually what happened. And the difference is important. And so, by like manner, when people say things like, oh, politician X is just stupid. Well, certainly they do stupid things. But most of the stupid things they do are stupid like a fox.
David,
like yes?
Hold that thought. We're going to take our final break, and we'll return with this conversation. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, concluding my conversation with David Arnold. David, we can pick it up here wherever you might like, and because I know that there's a lot you have yet to say, so please do.
Okay, well, I hope we don't leave anybody hanging, but aside from the five steps of bystanders, and I think that we are bystanders with respect to an awful lot of this because few of us are actually involved in the events of 9/11 or chemtrails, et cetera. So we're bystanders. So it's important to study what we are and how we behave and then take a deliberate conscious, reflective attitude toward that and choose what to do as best we can. Teller of Penn and Teller, the magician, came to mind, I beg your pardon, because I thought, you know, a lot of what's going on with keeping people from those five steps is magic. It's redirection, misdirection of attention, reinterpretation, prior planning, setups, all sorts of things that, that occur in magic tricks. And so I, by luck, ran across a wonderful article on the Smithsonian website where Teller goes through seven steps to a good trick. And I personally see these in all of these social issues that are hidden in plain sight. And if I can, I'll go through the steps of those.
Please, please. Yeah, do.
So, number one, and by the way, Teller has legally changed his name to just Teller. He doesn't have any other name. Teller says step number one is exploit pattern recognition. So he then describes that he produces four silver dollars, one at a time, with the back of his hand toward the audience. Then he lets you see the empty palm of his hand and produces a fifth coin. As a human, you take away the impression that all five coins came from a hand whose palm was empty. Of course, that's not the case. But it uses our pattern recognition to trick us into believing something about the situation that we didn't even see because we infer a pattern. So the second thing that he does is he says, make the secret a lot more trouble than the trick seems worth. So then they go on to a description of a trick they did on a TV show where they produced 500 cockroaches on a desk. And it involved finding cockroaches that moved slowly, which was hard to do, and 18 months, actually, of preparation for a trick that lasted, you know, less than 4 minutes. And so, make the secret a lot more trouble than the trick seems worth. Who would put 18 months into a trick that they're going to show once? Well, Penn and Teller. You'll be fooled by a trick if it involves more time, money, and practice than you or any other sane onlooker would be willing to invest. And I think that has enormous implications for the false flag activities and a lot of other things that go on in our world that are illegitimate. But there's seven of these steps, and I want to get through them relatively rapidly and then maybe get your thoughts on some of
these. Yes, yes, yes. Well, I can already see their application in 9/11.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just...
Number three...
I've just authored or co-authored three studies about the plane crashes, all of which were fabricated. You can find them on Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer, but it's just astonishing how much fakery and fraud went into devising these illusory plane crashes. Very, very interesting. Each one was done in a different way.
And there's plainly a lack of evidence of an airplane at each one of the places.
Yeah, that's also true. Yes, yes, yes.
Incredible.
So it should be a telling sign, but you know.
Well, it is, except that we have human minds that have these patterns, like pattern recognition, and so we can be led. So number three is it's hard to think critically if you're laughing.
Right.
So he follows that with, we often follow a secret move immediately with a joke. A viewer has only so much attention to give, and if he's laughing, his mind is too busy with the joke to backtrack rationally. So it's an ability to prevent rational backtracking.
Just to go back to your pattern recognition, I think what we're really talking about is conceptual closure. In other words, you have certain concepts that are familiar to you, and when you see enough indicators that a certain concept applies, you tend to subsume it by means of that concept. You know, you have certain stimuli, you know, which can be from the various senses, et cetera, that tend to bring about closure. And if, in fact, the stimuli are caused by a variety of disparate sources rather than the one that you're subsuming, you can commit a blunder. It's what they do in the movies all the time. You know, we aren't really, you hear the sounds of the machine gun and you see the blood splattering and the bodies flying and all that. And you tend to treat it as though it were a bona fide attack when each one of those elements has its own separate cause that we're simply subsuming by means of, you know, our familiarity, which is ubiquitous in this culture, which is so violent-oriented that we're talking, you know, witnessing a violent military attack or who knows what, some other, yeah. Just a further reflection on that one, David.
Right. Absolutely. So with number three, it's hard to think critically if you're laughing. I would assume that this has to do with the midbrain and the emotional response, and that when you move to the midbrain, your frontal cortex gets de-emphasized, and so if you were terrified or you were scared, it would probably have the same effect, but they probably don't get as many people buying tickets to their show if they scare their audience, so they stick with laughing. In any case, it's an emotional rather than intellectual activity that your brain's involved in, and so it messes up your ability to backtrack rationally. And I think that's clearly something that happens to keep us off the track. Number four is keep the trickery outside the frame. And with this, he explains that he takes off his jacket and tosses it aside. Then he reaches into your pocket and pulls out a tarantula. So getting rid of the jacket was just for comfort, right? Not exactly. That's where the tarantula came from. But it keeps the trickery outside the frame. So now he's got the spider, he pulls it out of your pocket, and it's a pretty good trick. And how many people would connect him taking off his jacket with finding a tarantula in your pocket? It doesn't make sense, and so people don't make that connection, you know. Number five, to fool the mind, combine at least two tricks. So here he says, every night in Las Vegas I make a children's ball come to life like a trained dog. My method, the thing that fools your eye, is to puppeteer the ball with a thread too fine to be seen from the audience. But during the routine, the ball jumps through a wooden hoop several times, and that seems to rule out the possibility of a thread. The hoop is what magicians call misdirection, a second trick that proves the first. The hoop is genuine, but the deceptive choreography I took months to develop. And then he says, see number two, more trouble than it's worth. So he's saying that the trick to the trick is you put in more time than it seems to be worth, and you combine more than one trick, and it fools the mind.
This is very useful. It's like flying the plane toward the building, you know, too high actually to hit a lamppost, swerving over the building at the same time the explosion goes off. So you've got a phony explosion combined with a phony approach, and, of course, right. The mind puts together the false cause with the false effect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And number six is the one that I think will really appeal to you. Nothing fools you better than the lie you tell yourself. He gives credit to David P. Abbott, who was an Omaha magician who invented the basis of his trick in 1907. He used to make a golden ball float around his parlor. After the show, Abbott would absent-mindedly leave the ball on a bookshelf while he left to the kitchen for refreshments. Guests would sneak over, heft the ball, and find it was much heavier than a thread could support, so they were mystified. But the ball the audience had seen floating weighed only 5 ounces. The one on the bookshelf was a heavy duplicate left out to entice the curious. When a magician lets you notice something on your own, his lie becomes impenetrable. And I think that from the 17-second video delay of 9/11, in the so-called live images, we're on the roller coaster from that point on. We've been allowed to notice things, and the lie becomes impenetrable because it's the lie we tell ourselves. And I think that mechanism gets used over and over and over with partial truth releases so that we fill it in incorrectly. There's a heavy gold ball on the shelf. It couldn't have been floating around the ceiling. In point of fact, it wasn't.
That's right.
But how many people take the step to make that very valid assumption?
Right.
A conclusion. It's a hard step.
Yeah, it should be. If this ball was floating around, then it had to be very light. This ball, however, is not light. It's very heavy. So you should draw the inference it was not the ball that was floating around.
That's right. I mean, that's what we should do. But, of course, that's not what we do. Our brains are built to handle different problems and to use assumptions for a number of really good reasons. For survivability of a species, but not necessarily for correct answers in physics and math. So number 7 is, if you're given a choice, you believe you have acted freely. He says this is one of the darkest of all psychological secrets. And so his card trick is he cuts a deck of cards. He lets you see several different cards. He turns them face down and says, pick one, memorize it, and put it back. And then he says, name your card. So someone says, for instance, the Queen of Hearts. He takes the deck in his mouth, he bites down, he groans and wiggles, and he pretends the card is going through his body and into his right foot. He lifts that foot and he invites you to take off his shoe and look inside. And there you find the Queen of Hearts.
Amazing.
You're amazed.
Yes.
If you happen to pick up the deck later, you'll find it's missing the Queen of Hearts. All right. So what's the secret? Well, this thing has all 7 of these steps in it. So first is preparation. He puts a Queen of Hearts in his right shoe, an Ace of Spades in his left shoe, and a 3 of Clubs in his wallet. Then he manufactures an entire deck out of duplicates of those 3 cards. It takes 18 decks, which is costly and tedious. Rule number 2, it's more trouble than it's worth. When he cuts the cards, he lets you glimpse a few different faces. You conclude the deck contains 52 different cards, but it doesn't. That's number 1, pattern recognition. You recognize a pattern, so you extend it beyond the data.
You assume it's a normal deck. Yeah.
Right. You assume it's a normal deck. You think you've made a choice, just as when you choose between 2 candidates presented by entrenched political parties. Number 7, choice is not freedom.
When choices are rigged, yes, that's right. You know, when they're constrained.
When choices are rigged.
When it's a specious bifurcation, you think as though there are only 2 choices. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. You're either going to vote for Mitt Romney or you're going to vote for Barack Obama. Of course, there's a problem with balloting.
Well, they fix the situation so that they choose our choices.
Yes.
Just like he chose the choices. You can only choose 1 of 3 cards.
Yes.
So you don't know that, but he does.
Yeah, so he's got them primed 3 different locations, so whichever you pick, he's going to find it in his wallet or his left shoe or right.
So then he wiggles the card to his shoe. Now you're laughing. Because you're laughing, your cognitive processes have been impaired. The other thing you can
do. Oh, that's a nice touch. Yes. You're laughing because it's as though it was passing through the body.
Right. And
like one of the aliens, you know, passing into your body, or one of these, you know, these horror films on TV all the time. Of course, you see these creatures going through your body. Weird stuff. But this is deliberate humor as distraction and cognitive interruption. That's good.
That's right. And, of course, there are a lot of things that can interrupt cognition. If you flatter somebody, it impairs their thinking for 20 minutes.
Really?
Yes, from what
I understand. That's fascinating. That is fascinating.
So anytime I get flattered, I become very careful.
Very suspicious. Very suspicious.
But, you know, being careful is sort of like being drunk and driving carefully.
Yes.
You can try to be careful, but you're still drunk. So it's an illusion that you have that kind of control.
That's very damned interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
So knowledge is not always power. Sometimes knowledge is just watching a train wreck and knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah, certainly not going to make you happier.
Not necessarily. So number four, so he turns away. You're laughing because of his wiggle to the shoe. So now you're not thinking. So then he turns away. Number four, he gets outside the frame of the trick, and he swaps the deck for a normal one, from which he's already removed all three possible cards. Now, most people aren't going to realize that any cards other than the one they picked is missing.
Yes.
So it's safe for virtually
More trouble than it's worth again.
That's right, but it's also preparation.
You know, that more trouble than it's worth is very, very interesting, because that has, you know, that brings in Occam's razor, where the simplest theory is preferable, but there's a qualification there, provided it can explain all of the evidence as well as the alternative. And, of course, we're talking here about magic tricks, just as on 9/11, that the simpler theory, which is the trick itself, of course, is actually not accounting at all for all the evidence if you only knew everything that was involved in rigging the scenario. So it's a very clever situation to appeal to a psychological tendency to accept the simplest, in this case, the one that seems to fit, that because you've gone to more trouble than it would be worth. That's a very, very interesting insight, David.
Right. And I personally actually object to the retranslation of Occam's razor. I understand what he actually said was, don't multiply unnecessarily.
Entities beyond necessity.
Okay. And so I think that by morphing that into the simplest explanation is usually the best, that's not actually what he said. That's a conclusionary kind of concept, and his was a process-oriented concept. And in that difference, I think, is an immense gulf.
No, say more about that.
A process, he said, don't over-process your math. He's talking about the process. And
well, really, he's really saying don't appeal to more factors than you need to appeal to count for to get the job done of explaining.
Well, see, now that's interesting, because what I'd rather think is that what he's saying is don't use more factors, not don't appeal to more.
Well, don't invoke, and don't require, don't deploy. I mean, there are lots of ways we could say this.
Well, right, but deploying them. Say, for instance, you multiply by a 2, that's unnecessary.
Well, the real point of Occam, see, is that you keep your explanation roughly as elegant or economical without appealing to. But the real catch, David, is it's got to be able to account for all of the data that you're going to explain, all the evidence.
And, of course, that flies in the face of all significant choices are always made with insufficient information.
Well, you know, you can always acquire more data and then find that your old explanation doesn't extend to it, and therefore you got to revise it. So you have to reject hypotheses previously accepted and accept hypotheses previously rejected. But you're I find it very interesting what you're saying. I mean, I even publish on Occam's Razor, so, you know, go ahead.
No, see,
everything you've been talking about, David, is very philosophical, okay? That's one reason I'm so intrigued. It's like you're a natural-born philosopher. I mean, I don't know, have you ever studied philosophy?
Not formally.
Yeah, well, you have a very philosophical cast of mind. I mean, in the beginning, I wasn't, I didn't have that impression. The more we have talked, the more obvious it's become to me that you have a very philosophical cast of mind. And that's, I like, you know, I find very interesting having this conversation with you.
So we have an interesting thing that I think happens. If we discover something like chemtrails are real, we start to talk about chemtrails. And we focus on detail and data. And we engage unwittingly in analysis paralysis. As soon as we know what's really up, we need to move on.
Oh, and take other steps, you mean. Once you've done the noticing
right. And
the interpretation, that's not the end of the matter.
That is exactly right. And
I think
so,
it's the role. I think it's the role responsibility. Even people who notice don't feel they have a role to do more than that. You know, they might want to have pure intellectual understanding, but don't appreciate that they may have a greater obligation than that.
Well, and then number four for me, know how to help, has actually been one of the places that has driven me nuts, because I'll walk up to someone who's an expert in a field and say, okay, so bearing in mind all of reality, the way we understand it, the political system is corrupt, the economic system is corrupt, et cetera. I won't list them all. What can we really do? Letters to the editor, maybe. Maybe not. Vote for somebody different, campaign for somebody different, maybe not. What is it that we can do that really will have an influence? And I think one of the toughest things that we can do is be the change we want to see in others.
Yes,
because it's
yes. The
only place where we can actually test whether our efforts are having a real effect. And if we have just a few more minutes, I have a story I'd like to tell.
Well, I think that's the catch, because I really wish that we had that 25 minutes we lost at the beginning. Let me promise this, David, I'm going to have you back.
Okay.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Thank you, my special guest, David Arnold, who had a lot of interesting things to say. I promise I'm going to bring him back. Thank you, David, for being here. And all of
thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Fakeologist Master Fake Theater. For more information on this and other audios, please go to fakeologist.com. If you like this production, please encourage Fakeologist and send a small monthly donation of just $1.19 a month to Fakeologist on PayPal. Thank you, and tune in again for another edition of Master Fake Theater.